Good morning, everyone. It's always good to be with you. I've been encouraged already this morning and learned a lot from class. Thanks, Kevin, for the class. And I hope that, appreciated Bill's prayer, that's my prayer as well, that this is edifying as well. Thanks, Adam, for the reading in Isaiah chapter 58. We're going to, Lord willing, get back to that passage here shortly. But the passage that really kind of served as a catalyst or a jumping off point for my thoughts this morning is actually found in the New Testament in Matthew chapter 11. So I'm going to read a few verses from Matthew chapter 11 here. They're very familiar words of our Savior that I think most of us have heard many times. Matthew chapter 11, starting in verse 28, it says, "Come to me, all you who labor and are heavy laden, and I will give you rest. Take my yoke upon you and learn from me, for I am gentle and lowly in heart, and you will find rest for your souls, for my yoke is easy and my burden is light." I was trying to think about or estimate in my mind how many times I may have heard these words before in my life, between just my own personal Bible reading, hearing them referenced in talks like this one or in invitations, even from singing hymns in our hymnals that are inspired by these verses, like number 78 in the Red Book that we were singing from this morning, "Hark the Gentle Voice." I think between all of those ways, I'm guessing I've been exposed to these words, these thoughts, these sentiments well over 100 times, and that's probably a very conservative estimate on my part. And so it's a little bit embarrassing for me to admit that it just recently dawned on me and kind of struck me the other day as I was reading through those verses that what's described here doesn't really sound much like rest at all, at least not on the surface or in the terms that we're accustomed to and conditioned to thinking about the subject of rest. We live in a culture that primarily fixates on and promotes rest on a very physical and superficial level. It sounds, and as such, our minds really tend to restrict the definition of rest to mean really that which is devoid of activity or responsibility, that which requires no effort or engagement on our part, that which provides extreme comfort, it's pleasing to all of our senses, and it's focused really solely upon our own enjoyment. It's me time, it's self-care. And I'm going to confess to you, though, that when I close my eyes, and if you were to say, "Zach, I want you to picture the essence of rest," I would close my eyes and I would picture plush, oversized couches. I would picture hammocks under shade trees in the backyard. I would picture secluded beaches with an umbrella and maybe some waves lapping at my toes. I would picture a clear schedule and peace and quiet. So distilled down, really what we're talking about is comfortable and secure surroundings. No demands on me, on my time, on my energy, on my attention. And I really feel like I've got all that I need and I'm doing what I want. And yet, the image that Christ paints for us here in Matthew chapter 11 is far cry from the things that we just mentioned here. When we come to Christ for rest, we're not handed a pillow or donned with a plush bathrobe and fuzzy slippers and given a do not disturb sign. Rather, the Lord offers a yoke, albeit easy and useful and serviceable and well-fitted. He offers us a burden, albeit a light one. And he offers us instruction, albeit from a master who is gentle and lowly in heart. So his invitation to find rest for the soul is really a call to faithful action. It's not want to get away, but it's come. It's not take some time for yourself, but take my yoke. It's not turn off and tune out and unplug, but engage, learn, and learn from me. So not only does this imagery of a yoke imply rather rigorous labor or exertion, a tool is specifically designed to harness the power of a beast of burden to pull a plow or some other heavy load, but it also communicates the idea of subjection and submission and servitude. Throughout Scripture, a yoke is often used to describe or depict a state of bondage. We see that in Deuteronomy chapter 28. There, Moses is outlining the blessings for obedience versus the cursings for disobedience. And he says there, starting in verse 48 of that, or I'm sorry, 47 of that chapter, "Because you did not serve the Lord your God with joy and gladness of heart for the abundance of everything, therefore you shall serve your enemies, whom the Lord will send against you in hunger and thirst and nakedness, and in need of everything, and he will put a yoke of iron on your neck until he has destroyed you. In 1 Kings chapter 12, we talked a little bit in our class about the history of the nation of Israel and how that nation ended up dividing. And right before that division, you might recall what Israel's plea was to King Rehoboam there in 1 Kings chapter 12, verse 4. He says, your father, he's talking about Solomon there, he says, your father made our yoke heavy. Now, therefore, lighten the burdensome service of your father and his heavy yoke, which he put on us, and we will serve you. And even in the New Testament, in Galatians chapter 5, verse 1, Paul warns there against the false teaching of the Judaizing teachers. And he uses the same imagery there when he says, stand fast, therefore, in the liberty by which Christ has made us free, and do not be entangled again with a yoke of bondage. So while Christ is obviously contrasting his yoke, which he offers, to that which is man-made, that which is heavy, that which is oppressive, there is still a strong element of submission and subjection present in Christ's command to come to him. To come to him for rest is to actively give up. It's to forfeit our own will in order to submit to his authority, to his leadership, and to his direction. And again, that's not exactly the traditional picture of rest. And it's not something that many of us probably enjoy to hear when we think about kicking back and taking some time for ourselves. How do you expect me to truly rest and relax if I'm not even in control of my surroundings? If I'm not the one calling the shots? If I'm not the one setting the itinerary? These are all fleshly and carnal mindsets that are extremely prevalent and easy to fall into, but I believe that the Bible teaches us that they are enemies and impediments of the rest that Jesus Christ is offering here in Matthew chapter 11. I want to be abundantly clear before I go any further that I'm not saying this morning, or I'm not implying this morning, that physical or mental or emotional rest and refreshment is not necessary or unimportant. Nor is it my intent to guilt us into never taking a vacation again or taking some time to enjoy a relaxing hobby. Christ's own example shows that these things are not mutually exclusive or contradictory to one another. In Mark, the sixth chapter, we find these verses, 31 through 32, are really a prelude to Jesus feeding the 5,000 there. And we see there that he, Jesus, said to them, the apostles, come aside by yourselves to a deserted place and rest a while, for there were many coming and going, and they did not even have time to eat. So they departed to a deserted place in the boat by themselves. So Jesus saw the benefit of getting away to rest, to recharge. But even this took a distant back seat to the spiritual needs of the lost and the vulnerable multitudes, sheep without a shepherd who sought Jesus out. And when they find him later in this same chapter in the apostles, Jesus Christ does not rebuke them for interrupting a rare and precious moment of rest and respite and solace, like I may have been tempted to do. How dare you? We withdrew for a reason to rest and recharge. But that's not what we find Jesus doing. Instead, he has compassion on them, and he starts to teach them. As the song says, he will teach if you will learn. It really struck me just how starkly different God's beautiful design for rest is from the cheap and the empty, the unsatisfying, and really the destructive version that mankind often pursues. And this got me to looking a little bit deeper into what else the Bible has to say on this subject of rest. And I found the journey to be rather informative and thought-provoking for myself, at least. So this morning, I'd like to retrace just a few of those steps with you all and to highlight a few of the key takeaways or the main themes that I found, and hopefully these will stimulate some interest to further investigate on your own, because it will certainly be a summary. The idea, the concept, the institution of rest is one that God wasted no time in establishing. In the first few verses of Genesis chapter 2, we find God drawing his creative work to a close. He has just made the heavens and the earth and all that is in them, both visible and invisible, in 6 days. He's looked out over that fresh and untainted creation and declared it to be very good. And then on the seventh day, God caps his creative work by doing something that was unique. It was something that was special. Genesis chapter 2, starting in verse 1, it says, thus the heavens and the earth and all the host in them were finished. And on the seventh day, God ended his work which he had done, and he rested on the seventh day from all his work which he had done. Then God blessed the seventh day and sanctified it, because in it he rested from all his work which God had created and made. It's easy to read past these brief and really rather nondescript verses here without giving them too much thought. I know I've done it a lot of times before. But as I prepared for this lesson, it really became quickly apparent that what God did here and what God accomplished here, what God established on this day, is rather profound and significant. And it has lasting and enduring implications throughout his interactions with his people. Even reading these verses now, I'm left wondering, I'm left wanting more detail on what exactly transpired on this seventh day. What did it look like? What were the proceedings and the goings on? What was the immediate impact that it had on God's brand new creation? Was there interaction and instruction going on between God and man? Was worship occurring? I don't know. We're simply not told. But what I do know, and as we're going to see over the next few minutes, is that what God does here at the end of this creation week is both extremely important and sacred to him, but it's foundational, it's fundamental to a proper understanding and application of God's defined rest, how God defines it. In many ways, or in fact, many of God's commandments and instructions to his people regarding this very topic are directly tied to what he himself does here in Genesis chapter 2. And so let's take just a few minutes to make some observations regarding this introduction, or maybe we could call it a prototype of rest before we move on. I think the first thing that we can see here in Genesis chapter 2 is that God's rest, unlike our own, is not a reaction or a response to exhaustion or overexertion. This is not a matter of diminished power or energy or capability. This is clear from the Hebrew word that is used here and that's translated rest in our English versions. And that is the word Shabbat, which means to cease, to desist, to rest, to be completed. This wasn't God having to stop and catch his breath or recharge his batteries after a long week of work, like we often have to. This isn't God having to take a break so he can continue being God and get ready for the grind of a new week. In Isaiah chapter 40 and verse 28, it says, "Have you not known? Have you not heard the everlasting God, the Lord, the creator of the ends of the earth, neither faints nor is weary? His understanding is unsearchable." God never faints or grows weary. So there must be something deeper. There must be something more profound involved than what might first meet the eye. This was a conscious, proactive, and purposeful decision by God to rest, to cease, to desist, and to indicate in no uncertain terms that his creative work was done. It was finished. As we touched on just a minute ago, I think the second thing we can see from this passage that this was clearly something that was very special and important to God. In Genesis chapter 1, just preceding this, he has previously blessed aspects of his creation. He does so with the fish and fowl on the fifth day in Genesis chapter 1 and verse 22. He does so with mankind on the sixth day in verse 28 of chapter 1. But here God blesses and sanctifies the seventh day because for the fact that he rested. And we'll see shortly that God considers this to be holy and just how seriously he views how holy this is. The third thing I think we can learn from this verse or this passage is that this institution of rest obviously predates by thousands of years the Sabbath law given to Israel, and many of the passages that likely spring to mind when we think about this topic biblically, this idea of rest. This leads me to believe that there is much more general and universal meaning and application to this concept of rest beyond what we see given in the law of Moses, and a fact that we'll touch on a little bit more here in a few minutes. And fourth and finally, I just want to point out that this what made this day of rest special and set apart had nothing to do with mankind or any of God's creation for that matter. What made this day special and set apart was a result of what God did. It's a result of what God decided to do or not do, and what God alone did. These are very basic, fundamental, obvious observations, but I think they really help provide some important context, some important perspective of this topic as we progress through God's Word and his interactions with mankind throughout history. After Genesis chapter 2, there's a relatively long silent period for roughly 2,500 years until Israel's exodus that we don't hear a lot about this subject. But from this point forward, from the deliverance of Egypt and slavery of Egypt, there's really an explosion of information and instruction regarding this topic of rest, and particularly in the books of the law that we'll touch on just a few of those really quickly. In Exodus chapter 16, God responds to complaints. Israel's been brought out of Egypt. They're traveling in the wilderness. He's responding to complaints there of hunger of the children of Israel, and he sustains them, and he tests them with bread from heaven. We might call it manna, or God calls it manna. And for 6 days, they were to collect only enough for that one day. And then on the seventh day, they were to collect a double portion, enough for that day and the next, the seventh day being a Sabbath day of rest. So here again, we see it was God's action, or God's inaction, that made the day special or set apart. He was the one that was preserving the double portion, and he was the one keeping the manna from falling the seventh day. So, we also see here in this very first encounter with rest in the children of Israel, their first failure to obey this observance. On the first 5 days, we see some trying to go out and gather more than their allotment, presumably having to avoid work the next day. Maybe they wanted to sleep in, I don't know. But they woke up to rotten and wormy provisions. And then they turned around on the seventh day and went out to go look for manna and didn't find any. We see several weeks later in Exodus chapter 20, God really codifies this observance and remembrance of the Sabbath with Israel and the Ten Commandments. And from that chapter, we find that this was to be a day of rest. There was to be no work done. We see that in verse 10 of chapter 20. It was a holy day, a day observed to the Lord, verses 8 and 10 of that chapter. And it was a day that was based on and rooted in, it drew its significance from looking back to God's own rest in Genesis chapter 2. And we see that very clearly in verse 11 of Exodus chapter 20. This may be a little bit of an aside, but I often think that I at least underappreciate and underestimate just how much of a culture shock this period of time would have been to this group of Israelites. Not only had they witnessed and participated themselves in some very awesome and miraculous events over the past several months, but their entire way of life has changed and been redefined almost overnight here. These are people that had been slaves their entire lives. They had undoubtedly labored in dirty and filthy and laborious and mundane tasks day in and day out. They were directed and driven and micromanaged by likely harsh taskmasters each step of their way, and now they had a day of rest. And it wasn't a day of rest just to relax and unwind, although I imagine that would have been a great blessing and a welcome benefit, but there was something far more critical and valuable that Israel was to gain from this day of pause, from this day of rest. They were being retrained. They were being reprogrammed to stop and to consider and to remember. To remember and honor who it was that had delivered them and that was leading them now, their holy creator and redeemer. When things would get rough, and they were going to get rough in short order, they were to remember what the psalmist wrote in Psalm 46, starting in verse 10, when it says, "Be still," stop, "be still, and know that I am God. I will be exalted among the nations. I will be exalted in the earth. The Lord of hosts is with us. The Lord of Jacob is our refuge," Selah. Instead of having to be driven each step of the way, they were now had an obligation and an expectation to be led, to follow, to distinguish themselves between what was common and what was holy, to manage their lives and to honor what was holy and to choose what was holy first. And we see that in the first three commandments that the Lord gives to Moses. In Exodus chapter 23, we see the Sabbath command reiterated, and an emphasis there is placed on rest and refreshing intended both for man and beast. And we also find additional instruction or requirements for the land, for the vineyards, resting, laying fallow on that seventh year for the good of the poor, that they could eat. This was not only to help the land, but this was to stimulate thoughtfulness and consideration and care for others, to protect against greed and overwork, robbing the fruitfulness that God was providing them. In Exodus chapter 31, the Sabbath is called a sign. It's a covenant between God and Israel throughout their generations, that you may know that I am the Lord who sanctifies you, verse 13. We also see just how seriously God views this covenant or this sign with his people. Twice in that passage, in Exodus chapter 31, the death penalty is prescribed to those who profane or dishonor the Sabbath. In verse 14, it says, "Everyone who profanes it surely will be put to death. For whoever does any work on it, that person shall be cut off from among his people." Verse 15, "Whoever does any work on the Sabbath day, he shall surely be put to death." Once again, going on in this passage, it appeals to God's own example and pattern for rest in Genesis chapter 2 for its meaning and for its holiness. What made that special to God and to his people? And finally, in Deuteronomy chapter 5, verses 12 through 15, I won't take the time to read that passage, but it really summarizes many of the previous Sabbath commands that we've been looking at already, and it adds this following purpose. It says, "And remember that you were a slave in the land of Egypt, and the Lord your God brought you out from there by a mighty hand and by an outstretched arm. Therefore, the Lord your God commanded you to keep the Sabbath day." Remember. Stop and remember. These laws, these signs, these covenants, these were given as a blessing for Israel and for their own good. This was for their own protection. To remember that God didn't rest because he had to, but because it was good for them. Because they needed it. In Mark chapter 2, verse 27, Jesus himself says the Sabbath was made for man and not man for the Sabbath. This rest was God given to keep his people focused on the holiness and the awesomeness of God, to recall what he had accomplished for them, how he had sustained them, how he had made them, he had formed them, how he had brought them out to trust in him for reliance, to prevent them from becoming brutal and unloving, unfeeling and oppressive, just like all the other nations around them that God intended to expel from the promised land and to give them rest from their enemies. Unfortunately, Israel's track record shows that they largely and habitually failed to embrace these lessons and instructions, and as a result, they often forfeited the rest that God desired to give them. The generation that exited Egypt rebelled in the wilderness. They put God to the test, causing him to swear in his wrath that they would not enter his rest. The following generation that did inherit the land refused to follow God's command to utterly destroy the inhabitants of Canaan, resulted in a constant thorn in their side of idolatry. And in the prophets, we see time and time again, the generations that followed disregarded, they disdained what should have been a cherished and sacred practice. God warned Israel's rulers through the prophets like Jeremiah that we talked about this morning in chapter 17, verses 19 through 27, that a failure to hallow the Sabbath would result in Israel's destruction. And yet it says in verse 23 of that 17th chapter of Jeremiah, "They did not obey, nor incline their ear, but made their necks stiff, that they might not hear or receive instruction." In Ezekiel chapter 20, it recounts how despite God's mercy and long-suffering, generation after generation profaned, they defiled the Sabbath instead turning to idols. And it's interesting, and I think it's a little bit telling to me, that this failure to hallow the Sabbath is directly linked in these passages to idolatry and is what ultimately led to the children of Israel's captivity. I appreciate Adam reading the 58th chapter of Isaiah for us earlier, because in many ways this may offer one of the most concise summaries of Israel's corruption of God's rest during this period and God's response and reaction. We won't take the time to reread that passage, but in it, what we really saw was a people that presumed that their own actions or their own inactions was what provided importance and not God. Why don't you respond, God? I'm doing something. Why don't you respond? Why don't you hear? We see people that sought their own pleasure and they exploited their own labors despite this outward show of piety. We saw people that failed to focus on God and who He is and what He has done for them and allowed that to inform and motivate their attitudes and actions, and it caused them to miss the meaning and the intent of God's law altogether, to let the oppressed go free, to lift the burden and shed the yoke, to share bread with the hungry and to cover the naked, to thank, to care about one another, to have compassion. And as a result, they failed to honor God in exchange for what it says in that passage, doing their own ways, finding their own pleasures, speaking their own words, taking more delight in their own things rather than God's. Even in their observance, if you want to call it that, their observance of God's rest, it had all become about me, 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 me. And that is the very definition of idolatry. They were essentially trampling the holy and the sacred while chasing after the common and the profane. Even in the New Testament, we see throughout Christ's own ministry that the way the Jewish leaders of that time continued to twist the Sabbath from what God had intended. I don't know if ironic's the right word. I find it sad. I find it borderline unbelievable that the scribes and the Pharisees on several occasions attempt to use the Sabbath as a trap by which they could catch Jesus. We remember them doing that when his disciples are going to the grain fields and plucking heads of grain and eating them. We see that when Jesus heals a man on the Sabbath. They're just watching and waiting for him to do something they considered or deemed unlawful in order to discredit or accuse him of wrongdoing. And when you stop and think about how twisted and how sick and how perverted that is for a minute, here we have the Son of God. We have the one by whom all things were made, the one for whom all things were made, the very one who was engaged in every act of creation, who was there in Genesis chapter 2 and instituted this very institution of rest. And he had been there with the children of Israel in the wilderness every step of the way when Moses gave the law to the children of Israel, leading them, sustaining them. And now he's standing before this group of men being brought up on fraudulent and erroneous charges by those who had turned the blessing of God's rest into a heavy burden. And that's what Jesus says in Matthew chapter 23, verses 4 and 5. This is just part of what Jesus condemns the scribes and Pharisees for in pronouncing the woes on them there when he says, "For they bind heavy burdens, hard to bear, and lay them on men's shoulders, but they themselves will not move them with one of their fingers, but all their works they do to be seen by men." I know that was a rather long and winding road, but that is the backdrop. That is the background against which our Lord's invitation is given in Matthew chapter 11, verses 28 through 30, when he says, "Come to me. Come to me. All you who labor and are heavy laden, and I will give you rest. Take my yoke upon you and learn from me, for I am gentle and lowly in heart, and you will find rest for your souls, for my yoke is easy and my burden is light." You may be wondering why we spent so much time in the Old Testament. What does any of this have to do with us today? We've been talking about a group of people that lived thousands of years ago. They operated under a different dispensation. They were subject to laws that are now obsolete. How can this possibly be relevant to us? Well, I think Colossians chapter 2, verses 16 to 17 help us answer that question. It says, "So let no one judge you in food or in drink or regarding a festival or a new moon or Sabbath, which are a shadow of things to come, but the substance is of Christ." It is true that the focus and the requirement is no longer on a physical, literal day of rest or a festival, which were merely shadows of things to come. But this fact only brings into a more intense focus in my mind a critical question that remains, that confronts each one of us now in 2023. And that is, how are we going to approach the reality of what gave those things meaning and purpose in the first place? And that is Jesus Christ. This is what the balance of the book of Hebrews, especially chapters 3 and 4, is all about. Unfortunately, we don't have time to read that passage. I would encourage you to do that later. But I do want to quickly summarize just a few of the main points and the lines of reasoning that are found there. In Hebrews chapter 3, verses 7 through 19, we find that we should learn from, we should be warned by the example and the result of disobedience by those Israelites who were given the commands that we looked at earlier. And the language there is very strong. In Hebrews chapter 3, verse 12, it says, "Beware, brethren, lest there be in any of you an evil heart of unbelief and departing from the living God." In chapter 4, verse 1, it says, "Therefore, since a promise remains of entry in his rest, let us fear, lest any of you seem to have come short of it." Despite witnessing and participating in some amazing things and receiving wonderful blessings, verse 16 of chapter 3 says that all who came out of Egypt led by Moses rebelled. They sinned and fell in the wilderness. And these same dangers, the same selfish tendencies and traps of disobedience are just as prevalent and pervasive today as they were then. The inclination to allow our perception of external circumstances to control our actions and responses rather than stopping and thinking and remembering and being still and knowing that God is in control. In chapter 4, the first 9 verses of that chapter, we see there that there does remain a rest for God's people. If the rest that was given to the children of Israel who failed to enter due to their disobedience was the only rest intended, it says that Joshua leading the conquest of Canaan had, or if Joshua leading the conquest of Canaan had delivered the type of rest that God had in mind, then David would not have written as he did in Psalm 95 some 400 years later, speaking of the opportunity and expectation of entering God's rest being available today. That's the reasoning, that's the argument that's being made there in a nutshell. And I want to just highlight verse 10 of chapter 4, because not only does it remind us that a rest does remain for the people of God, but that rest, it says, finds its basis. It finds its meaning. It finds its significance in the very same reality that God had been pointing to all along from Genesis chapter 2. God had completed his work. God had completed his work. I believe what this passage and what the balance of the book of Hebrews is telling us is that just as God put a thorough end, completing and perfecting his creative work, God through Jesus Christ has put a thorough end, completing and perfecting his redemptive work and making available his true rest found in Jesus Christ. That's what the writer of Hebrews goes on to highlight at the end of chapter 9 and throughout chapter 10, the perfection, the finality of Christ's sacrifice, the fulfillment of all these things we've been talking about this morning, who appeared once at the ends of the ages to put away sin by the sacrifice of himself. He was offered once to bear the sins of many. We have been sanctified through the offering of the body of Jesus Christ once for all. By one offering, he has perfected forever those who are being sanctified. To quote Christ's final words on the cross from John chapter 19, verse 30, "It is finished." The rest is real. It's available. It's precious. And it's holy. And it's sacred. And it's to be honored and revealed faithfully because of who God is and what God has done for us through Jesus Christ. Just like the Israelites, it's something that God expects us to take seriously. It's something that's important to him, and it should be important to us. The Israelites were denied entry to God's rest. They were destroyed in the wilderness for a lack of honor and respect and obedience, a lack of faith in what God and what they had seen and heard, for trampling on the holy things, the sacred things, the signs, the covenants that they had been given. And that makes what the writer of Hebrews says in chapter 10, verses 20 through 29, extremely sobering to me when he says, "Anyone who has rejected Moses' law dies without mercy on the testimony of two or three witnesses. Of how much worse punishment do you suppose will be thought worthy? Who has trampled the Son of God underfoot, counted the blood of the covenant by which he was sanctified a common thing, and insulted the Spirit of grace?" As we've seen this morning, a proper and faithful response to God's provided rest doesn't come naturally. It doesn't happen automatically. And that's why we see in Hebrews chapter 4, verse 11, it says, "Let us therefore be diligent." Let us therefore be diligent to enter that rest, lest anyone fall according to the same example of disobedience. This lesson has been a true gut check for me, and it's revealed in many ways I have a long ways to go. I've got a lot of endurance that needs to be had, but I want to get there. I want more than anything to get there, and I want all of you to get there as well. That may mean I spend a little less time reclining on the couch. That may mean I spend a little less time grinding on mundane work tasks around the office. That may mean I spend a little less time working on home improvement projects to try to make my surroundings more comfortable. And that may mean I spend a little more time stopping, remembering, praying, and learning from Him who can provide true rest. I hope this lesson has been encouraging to you to avoid the deceitfulness of sin and disobedience that robs us all of the true rest that's found in Jesus Christ, and to rejoice in the work that He's equipped us to do. If you've never responded to the gospel and Christ's invitation, as the writer in Hebrews says, today, if you will hear His voice, do not harden your heart. If you're weary and weighed down by sin and the cares of this life, then we invite you now to come to Him and accept the rest that He has to offer as we stand and sing the invitation number.